Case 21-6121, USA versus Curtis Gordon Jr. Argument not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Mr. Thomason, you may proceed for the appellant.
Morning.
Morning. Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. Alex Thomason appearing on behalf of the appellant in this case, Curtis Gordon Jr. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. The district court's decision granting the IRS's summary judgment motion is wrong and should be reversed for two reasons. First, claim preclusion does not apply offensively in this case to bar Curtis from challenging the accuracy and validity of the tax assessments that the IRS made against him prior to the tax court proceeding. And second, without preclusion, the IRS did not meet its summary judgment burden. On my first point, the United States Supreme Court unanimously acknowledged a little more than 2 years ago that there may be good reasons to question any application of claim preclusion to defenses.
I don't really understand why we even have to worry about claim preclusion per se in this case. It would seem to me that issue preclusion, which is a more pedestrian doctrine, I would say probably in this context, is probably enough to preclude your client from relitigating the deficiency determinations that the tax court made. What's wrong with that syllogism?
I think that's correct, and maybe even claim preclusion would bar the deficiency determinations, but the way that I view this case is we have three sets of assessments, the 2007 assessments that were summarily assessed based on tax returns that were filed by my client. We have the 2011 assessments that were based on these 2010 returns, and then we have these civil penalty assessments that came out of tax court.
So which deficiencies were the subject of your client? As I understand it, your client files a pro se petition with the tax court.
Yes.
Challenging certain, forgive me if I get the terminology messed up, assessments at that point by the IRS said you owe a certain amount.
Yes.
And he challenges that in the tax court.
He goes to tax court to challenge the penalty and the penalty assessments that the IRS was proposing to make and the $50 deficiency assessment, yes.
Right. And so what tax years were at issue in the tax court litigation?
2003, 4, and 5.
What tax year deficiencies are you challenging now?
Taxes, really what we're
challenging. Is it the same years?
It is the same year.
See, I mean, it seemed to me, as I'm recalling it, that the tax court determinations of deficiencies, which, you know, were reduced to judgment in the tax court, that those were embedded in each of your claims now, and that you're seeking to re-litigate those determinations by the tax court, which to my mind seem to be precluded by issue preclusion.
But I think it's important to note that the tax court order was incorporating a stipulation. And what?
Yeah. I mean, that's fine, whatever. I mean, judgments are judgments, aren't they?
Certainly, but what Curtis stipulated to when he was in tax court was to some adjustments to this amount of an underpayment that could then be used to calculate a civil penalty. But he didn't stipulate that those same adjustments should be then applied to these summary assessments that the IRS made in 2011, and that he would therefore be barred from precluding, or he would therefore be barred from challenging the accuracy and validity of those assessments at a later time. I think we have to look at what exactly it is.
Let's say he wins on everything you're asking for. Can he use that as a predicate to go back and challenge the penalties?
No. No,
why,
we're letting...
Why is that?
Because we're accepting that claim preclusion or issue preclusion either precludes any redetermination of the actual penalties themselves. We accept that. Maybe an analogous situation, and this isn't 100% analogous, but let's say you have a situation where a creditor sues a debtor on a note, and for some reason they enter into a settlement with respect only to the interest, and the creditor doesn't get any stipulation or a judgment on the principal itself. That's kind of what's happening here. The IRS is saying we want the principal too, but the principal is not what it's not exactly what was at issue.
In that case, is the interest derived? Do you have to know the principal in that example to know the interest? Because here you have to know the underlying amounts to know the penalty. The penalty is 75%.
That's exactly.
You have to know the one to know the other.
That's exactly right, Judge Radler. But if we think about this, how it would normally work in any other setting, the correct result in that case would be that the creditor can't bring the second suit to get the principal. They should have gotten it the first time. And what I'm submitting here is that if the IRS wanted Curtis to stipulate...
The so-called principal and penalty are linked together. It's just very strange to me. I mean, I think your concession's a good one to say I can't challenge the penalty, but I don't understand why that's true if you can do what you're doing to the so-called principal.
Because there was no actual agreement with respect to that amount in tax court. And that's...
It's a pretty good time to figure it out.
It certainly is a good time to figure it out, and that's why it's always been an issue with me when I look at this stipulation. Why wasn't Curtis asked to stipulate that these prior summary assessments were correct?
Well, how about this one way of thinking about it? Put the doctrines, issue, claim preclusion, any deficiency assessment, just put that all to the side. You can get rid of it all. What's unfair? Like, what is it that's wrong about what's happened so far? I mean, the imposter tax return, speaking for myself, is not going to get you far, but go for it if I'm just missing something.
Understood.
So what is it exactly that is the injustice right now?
Here's what's unfair about this. Curtis goes to tax court as a pro se litigant. He receives the notice of deficiency.
Okay, no, I'm saying, like, is there some, like, massive deduction he would get if you could do this again? Is there some, just they miscalculated, they didn't know how to do a percentile multiplication or something?
Certainly.
Does that exist in this case?
What's unfair here is the procedure. This is largely a case based...
asking for substance. The
whole point of my question is throw procedure, every doctrine to the side. How would you say to your mother or father what happened, if they're non-lawyers, what happened here that's unfair to your client in terms of presumably paying too much? I assume you're not here because he wants to pay more, right?
Right, that's correct.
Okay. That would amuse me. But so how is it that he's paying too much? Where's the mistake?
The mistake is with these 2011 assessments, and I cannot say, I don't have Curtis's financial information.
Well, I mean, I'm not very good with my poker face, forgive me, but we're not going to redo things. I don't care how many procedural doctrines there are, but it's very strange to revisit something if you can't show prejudice.
But
it's on you to show prejudice. He's your client. He's got the information where he could have shown that I had this option of getting a $100,000 deduction for these rental properties or the costs of maintaining them.
But that was seized from him in...
What was seized? The records?
Yes, these financial records were seized from him in relation to... the whole history here is very complicated.
But why can't you get them back? What's the problem there?
We didn't get them back. We didn't get them back. At any point, I have not ever seen them, I guess is what I could say. I think the IRS is in possession of these records, but I think...
Does the record show that your client or you or somebody said we need these records to figure out if an injustice occurred?
No, and that's part of the problem here, and I will advise the court, I became involved in this case long after the discovery period had closed.
And I mean... Right, and I don't mean to interrupt.
No, go for it.
I mean, you know, your predecessor, I guess, counsel in the tax court didn't, like, do anything during the discovery period.
Right? Well, there was no counsel in the tax court, but yeah, it's in the district court,
but
he didn't.
Mr. Gordon or whoever didn't seek any discovery. The court extends the deadline 2 months, and so now we're here and you're not sure what documents are out there. I mean, this isn't where we sort of reopen discovery and say, well, let's get to the bottom of this.
And I certainly understand that, and I don't have an explanation for why original trial counsel didn't try to develop a record on any of these issues here, including what happened in tax court. But what I can say is that this was a case where it's not as if the IRS had put these exhibits that they ultimately relied on in support of their summary judgment motion into the record prior to the time that they moved for summary judgment. And when you have a case like that where...
There's one reason why counsel wouldn't have done it is because there's nothing to contest.
That's correct.
You already had one calculation. You had the whole proceeding. He either realized he wouldn't be able to contest it or he didn't have the grounds to contest it.
That may be correct, but and I think partially it could be, but for instance, these certificates of assessment that the IRS has relied on as part of their prima facie case to show that the 2011 assessments are accurate, look at them. It's Exhibit 9 to the IRS's summary judgment motion. They do not show where a tax return was ever filed by anyone on Curtis's behalf in December of 2010. There's no entry for that. Yet what the IRS has said in their appellate brief is that a return that was filed in December of 2010 resulted in these 2011 assessments. And that's really what we're targeting here. These 2011 assessments, we don't know how they even came to be. When I first got this case and I looked at these summary judgment exhibits, I thought, what is this quick assessment based on? There's nothing in the record that shows. And I've sort of had to reverse engineer, but have eventually found out that they were based on these 2010 assessments that do not show up in the record as ever having been filed by anyone. And that's the injustice here. And it is procedural, perhaps, but every taxpayer deserves a fair process.
Those were available, those were in existence before the tax court proceeding?
The certificates of assessment? No, they were not. These certificates of assessment.
So the 2011.
Yes, the fact that they had been assessed, yes.
So if you were his lawyer in the tax court, you would have asked the IRS for those?
Yes, I would have said.
So the point, I mean, it seems to me this comes down to sort of lack of counsel, because if you were his counsel, you would have asked for this. That's a natural thing you would have done in the tax court proceeding.
That's correct.
So the best argument I hear you making is that he didn't have counsel and we should take that into consideration.
That's largely part of it, yes. I mean, I think we have to think about what did Curtis think he was actually agreeing to in tax court. He was agreeing, making some stipulations, conceding some points, so that this civil penalty could be calculated, so that the IRS could then assess that civil penalty. But he didn't know and had no way of knowing that what was actually going to...
He could have asked. You said if you were his lawyer, you would have asked.
Yes, but by the same...
Not that he didn't have no way of knowing. But he didn't find out.
True, but by the same token, the IRS could have demanded that he stipulate to the accuracy of these 2011 assessments. And if they had, I don't think he would have done it, because at that...
We're not here trying to figure out what was going on in Mr. Gordon's head. I mean, it's just we're dealing with sort of, you know, the record, the documents. It's not this subjective inquiry.
That's correct, and it is a very cold record. But what we do have is a stipulation that doesn't show that Curtis actually stipulated to the accuracy of those 2011 assessments, and we have certificates of assessment that show that no tax returns were filed by anyone in December of 2010, and we have the IRS taking the position that these December 2010 tax returns are where we got the 2011 assessments. I'll reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
All right. Thank you. Thank you. Lyon? Good morning.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court. My name is Kathleen Lyon, and I represent the United States. In this case, we believe that claim preclusion does apply here because the same causes of action are at issue in the tax court proceeding, and in this case, specifically, there is the common nucleus of operative fact. In both cases, in that they're both...
Is there some case out there that provides the predicate for claim preclusion, or maybe it's a rule or a statute that says when you have a deficiency proceeding, an assessment proceeding, whatever it is, you have to bring all your claims and defenses at one time? I mean, I know how claim preclusion, res judicata works in other areas, mm-hmm. but... It doesn't seem fair to say it applies here if there's nothing in the rules or statute that says, hey, when we're talking about your 2003 tax return, now's the time to tell us everything. If you got good documents, bring me the good documents. You got evidence of a deduction that you didn't take, bring it. Is there something that says that, or is it a case that says it, or is it just general principles of claim preclusion that say it?
Well, we have cited... Sunin and Russell and...
What's the best one? Just tell me the one to read that makes it clear that claim preclusion applies in this tax setting.
Probably Finley. I'd say that's a very...
Which one?
Classic case. Finley, it's a Fifth Circuit case.
And does it say that courts apply the same claim preclusion principles they apply to common law actions
to
the statutory setting?
What I was pointing to Finley for is the proposition that when you go to court... to tax court with a notice of deficiency, the tax court has jurisdiction over everything, over the entire gamut. You know, that quote is from Russell, but Russell and Finley say essentially the same thing, which is also what Sunan says, the Supreme
Court. Okay, so you go to tax court, they have authority over everything, but does it then also say, and because of that, you got to raise it all then, and if you don't, you're going to run into trouble down the road if you try to raise something new?
Those cases don't, but I would point out in this case, I don't think there was any confusion on just based on record documents.
Well, I mean, it was a pro se. I mean, no lawyer, so for you to say no confusion.
Well, if you look at his petition, his petition raises the underlying liabilities. That's what he thought, that's what he went to tax court to do. He specifically says, and this is at page 355 of the record, he says that he is challenging the underlying liabilities because he's entitled to certain business deductions, and he says specifically that the penalties are wrong precisely because the underlying liabilities were erroneous. So that's what he was there to do.
That sounds more like issue preclusion.
Why do we need to worry about
easier.
Claim preclusion? The linchpin of everything here is these underlying liabilities, as you describe them. Isn't that accurate? I mean, if you're right about that, if those stick, his claims go down. We don't have to sort of, you know, run the rapids of this claim preclusion that the court sort of, you know, is unhappy about.
Correct. I understand it. I think this court could decide that, and it can raise it sua sponte on its own. If there's a legal issue that is supported by the record, then this court can reach that issue. But we do think it's fairly clear, even from the face of the stipulation, that the underlying liabilities were at issue and were resolved, because they specifically say that he adjusted the gross receipts and the mortgage interest deduction. And then we also pointed to, also in the record at page 57, which is the refund claim cover letter, where he represented, or his counsel represented to the IRS, that he discovered these allegedly forged returns during the tax court proceeding and then sat down with the IRS, two IRS attorneys and a revenue officer, and went, quote, line by line and page by page through these allegedly erroneous returns. And that's how we got these deductions in this case.
I think you might get a sense. We all sort of think the preclusion argument in some form may have traction. Why did you wait so long to raise it? If it seems maybe somewhat obvious to us.
Or maybe wait for us to raise it.
Well, certainly, Honor, we were thinking that because of the nature of a deficiency case, these are the same claims. I think that's why we were thinking it was res judicata, because the underlying liability is inherently part of a notice of deficiency kind of claim. And so that's, I think, why we were thinking of it that way. And it is true that we did not bring it up till the motion of summary judgment, but it's also accurate that the tax court decision has been an issue in this case since the complaint. The preclusive nature of the stipulation and the decision was brought up by Mr. Gordon in his answer at page 18 of the record.
Your complaint references the preclusionary aspects of the criminal judgment, and that he's no longer able to deny that he engaged in fraud, and that's in your complaint.
That's in the complaint.
So this seems sort of part and parcel, goes hand in hand with a second issue that would also be precluded, relitigating the numbers. That's not in your complaint.
That's not in the complaint. I would say, though, in the amended complaint, which changes the amount, if you look at the motion for the amended complaint, which is at pages 90 and 91 of the record, we explain that that because of the tax court stipulation, in the original complaint, we got the amount of the penalties correct, but we had gotten the amount of the underlying taxes wrong. And because of the tax court stipulation, we were adjusting the amended complaint to reflect the tax court determination of the taxes themselves.
You're fairly blunt about the criminal aspect, the criminal judgment. Mm-hmm. Your complaint just doesn't reference, to my reading, the tax court judgment the same way.
I think that's fair, yes.
Why is that? Or just a pleading decision, or?
I'm not certain. It could have just been a mistake. It could have been a pleading decision. But in this case, as we pointed out, he hasn't argued any prejudice. At the time that the government filed the motion for summary judgment, he then filed his motion to reopen discovery. He didn't seek any discovery with respect to the res judicata issue. He only sought it with respect to the underlying, the merits of the calculations of the taxes. And he didn't allege in the motion to reopen discovery that there was any prejudice. He mentioned it in passing in his response to the motion for summary judgment at page 421 of the record. He mentions that he was prejudiced in his ability to respond. He doesn't explain it. And so we don't think that he's identified any
this was in front of Judge Lauber in the tax court?
I believe so, yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah, just I had the Whirlpool case with him.
Ah, okay. Yes.
He's a fine judge. I'm always interested in knowing who the lower court judge was.
Yes. If the court has no further questions.
One other question. Yes. Do petitioners in these tax cases, are they typically represented by counsel? Is it sort of half and half, or was that unusual for?
Well, I don't know statistics, but I think pro se cases are fairly normal.
Really? Is the court required? Is the court giving instruction? You have the right to counsel, or is that ever part of the sort of preliminary parts of the proceeding?
I don't think so. I have not litigated in tax court, so I don't know for sure, but I don't believe so. But I certainly in this case, at the end, before the decision was entered, the tax court gave Mr. Gordon an opportunity to challenge the computations that came out of the stipulation, and he didn't do that. The tax court, in fact, ordered him to do it, to respond if he had any problems with it, and he didn't.
Just one kind of just matter of pure curiosity, I suppose. I mean, he's got this $50 deficiency mm-hmm. in these penalties that are like, you know, five-figure numbers and so
yes.
on. I mean, why is the deficiency only, why is this, you know, huge disparity in the amount of the deficiency and then the penalties?
Well, the penalties are statutory. I mean, if there's fraud, then that's a 75%. Penalty for the underpayment.
Right.
The underpayment was
of the gap, right? You know, of the underpayment?
Right, of the unpaid tax liabilities, yes. So
you have to bear with us, right?
Yes. If you have no further questions,
okay.
Thank you very
so much.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thomason, 2 minutes of rebuttal.
Just a few points on rebuttal. First of all, if all of the issues were on the table during the tax court proceeding, I go back to why was Curtis not actually asked to stipulate that he owed these summary assessments? It seems like it would have been very easy for the IRS attorney who was with him in that settlement discussion to say, look, I understand that you don't think you filed these returns, but just stipulate that you owed the amount. But they didn't do that, and it seems like they very...
Didn't they walk through that? Maybe I'm misremembering what happened when, but isn't that when they walk through it? It doesn't have a stipulation, but they walk through it with him.
Yes, they do walk through it, but he doesn't stipulate at the end of the day that the amount reported as being owed on those returns is correct, or even that...
I almost think that seems fair. In other words, I get nervous about unrepresented people being asked to stipulate to things. Why are you... Maybe I'm just missing the point you're making.
I think the point I'm making is that if Curtis had been asked to stipulate that the amounts reflected on these returns from 2010, that again, the IRS's own, their own certificates of assessment
show. Oh, I see. So this is the one, the missing, where you don't think there's a return.
Yes.
I got it. And the stipulation would fix that problem.
That's right. And again, on summary judgment, we have to look at the fact that the certificate of assessment shows no return in a light most favorable to Curtis. And I understand that it is a little far-fetched. We don't know where this return came from, though, but the IRS's own exhibits don't answer that question. They show that no return was filed at all in December of 2010, yet assessments were made based on that in 2011. I also want to address the issue preclusion point that you have raised, Judge Kethledge. Mm-hmm. The issue whether these tax returns were valid or signed or filed by the taxpayer was not actually litigated in tax court, as far as I can tell. This is, and I know very little about what happened in tax court. We have a very cold record here. But all we have is a stipulation, and he didn't say, this is my tax return. Go ahead and assess these amounts against me. They are correct. It's just not in there. And another point, Judge Raylor, I want to address with respect to waiver, I also wonder, why did the IRS not wait so long to raise this if it seems like such a slam dunk argument? If they had, though, raised it at the appropriate time or pursuant to the appropriate procedure, I think that this case would have gone a little differently. And here's what I mean by that. We have in the Sixth Circuit a rule that says it's okay to raise preclusion in a summary judgment motion, but the federal rules of civil procedure require it to be raised by pleading. So if in their motion for, if they had filed a second amended complaint in a motion for leave to amend their pleading and said, we want to raise this preclusion argument instead of a summary judgment motion, the IRS would have had to explain why they waited so long. They would have had to explain that they didn't act with a bad motive, and they would have had to show a lack of prejudice. The district court, though, didn't analyze any of that. I see my time is up. Thank you, Your Honors.
All right. Thanks to both of you for your helpful briefs and arguments.